Welcome to the Science Podcast for August 23rd, 2013. I'm Christy Hamilton.
And I'm Sarah Crespi. This week, ribosomopathies, defending the Earth against asteroids, and what's ticking with atomic clocks.
Such stable ticking really enables the measurement of time and frequency at a new level of precision. And this, in turn, opens the door to some new or improved applications.
Plus, a few stories from our online daily news site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
For many of us, as long as we get to work on time or know when to catch our next flight, we don't mind if our clocks are a couple of seconds or even a minute off. But for scientists, precision is everything, especially when it comes to tasks like tracking high-speed particles and testing Einstein's theory of relativity. Physicist Andrew Ludlow from the National Institute of Standards and Technology spoke with Linda Poon about an atomic clock that is even more precise than the world's current champion timekeeper.
We developed and refined two different next-generation atomic clocks. They operate at optical frequencies, and they use an atom called ytterbium. By comparing these two clocks, we were able to show that their ticking is stable at one part in 10 to the 18, which is about a quintillion. Such stable ticking really enables the measurement of time and frequency at a new level of precision. And this, in turn, opens the door to some new or improved applications of advanced timekeepers.
What is an optical lattice clock, and how does it work? How is it able to track time so accurately?
Okay, so most clocks have two basic pieces. The first is they have some device that repeats itself or oscillates in a very well-defined time interval. And then it has some other piece which counts those oscillations. And, you know, a good way to think of that is the pendulum clock. The thing that repeats itself or oscillates is the pendulum as it swings back and forth. And then there's the inner gear work in the clock face, which, you know, serve the function of actually counting that swinging. So an atomic clock is not so different from a pendulum clock. Instead of having some swinging pendulum, it uses some kind of electromagnetic oscillator to excite an electron in an atom. And because that electron can only be excited at a very precise frequency, the very act of exciting the atom gives you a measure or a calibration of what the frequency of the oscillator is. And then those oscillations are then counted by some additional device. And this is how you measure time. An optical lattice clock is a variety of atomic clock where the atom is excited by a laser at optical frequencies. The atoms themselves are laser cooled, which means they're cooled down to very cold temperatures, perhaps a millionth of degree Kelvin. And they're sitting inside what's known as an optical lattice, which is basically a very strong laser field, which is able to hold on to the atoms and prevent them from wandering around. Mm-hmm. Typically, there's thousands or hundreds of thousands of these atoms sitting inside this optical lattice. And you can use tricks so that holding on to the atoms with the optical lattice doesn't affect the electron which gets excited at the heart of the clock.
Mm-hmm. So you report on an optical clock with an instability that's close to 10 to the negative 18 levels. What does that mean in broad terms? Like, what exactly is a clock's instability?
So one way to think about the stability of a clock is how the ticking of a clock might change over time. If you think back to that pendulum clock, you can imagine that as that pendulum swings back and forth, the period with which it swings can change over time, either because the winding mechanism in a clock might be running down, or perhaps there's other physical phenomena, let's say temperature or humidity in the room, that ultimately could influence what that swinging rate or ticking rate of the clock is. The same is true for an atomic clock. Ultimately, if the interval of that ticking changes, it compromises your ability to measure time in a precise way. So ideally, you want that ticking rate to be completely and perfectly stable. we basically showed with the two ytterbium lattice clocks that we were able to keep their timing stable at 1 part in 10 to the 18 over a period of many hours. That basically means if you were to measure either some kind of time interval using that clock ticking, you would be able to measure that interval with a precision out to, you could write down a number with 18 digits, and you'd be able to clearly specify all of those 18 digits from a standpoint of the precision of the measurement.
So to find these results, you compare your two optical clocks. So first, were there any differences between these two clocks?
Yeah, so I guess from a fundamental perspective, the most important difference between the clocks is that while they both use ytterbium atoms, they are different ytterbium atoms. Mm-hmm. Furthermore, the apparatus for each clock and thus the atom's local environment, these are also different. And finally, most of the lasers used to manipulate the atoms in the clock are different as well. This is important because all of these things can, in principle, change or alter the frequency at which the atoms get excited. Mm-hmm. And so we need to be sure that the clocks are basically operating independent of each other. And this is because when we measure them against each other and use one against the other to tell us that the ticking is very stable, we need to be confident that there are not identical imperfections in both the clocks that make it hard to see those imperfections when we compare them.
So can you just kind of explain how you compare these clocks, like the process of it?
Yeah, you betcha. So once we can cool the atoms sufficiently low, we're able to hold on to them with this optical lattice. Once they're sitting in that lattice, we can basically use an additional laser to try to provoke a transition of the electron state of the atom. So it basically excites the electron of the atom. Mm-hmm. Once we monitor how the atom responds to the laser, the frequency of the laser is adjusted to make sure that the atom is being perfectly excited. That laser frequency is independently controlled for both clocks, and we compare one of those frequencies for one system against the other. And ultimately, this tells us if the frequency of either clock is changing. So in other words, we basically look directly at how the ticking in the atomic clock might be changing over time.
All right, well, the current atomic clock loses a second every 100 million years, and just last month, scientists created another one that's 3 times as accurate. So if you ask me, that's already pretty, like, amazingly accurate. So why chase this? What are the benefits of using even more accurate clocks?
Yeah. So that level of precision doesn't really matter in terms of, you know, more traditional applications, like making sure I get on time to a meeting. But in fact, there are a number of different both scientific and technical applications which become possible when you have a really fantastic timekeeper. So ideally, you want your clock to always tick at exactly the same rate forever. But for the good or the bad, the ticking of the atomic clocks actually can change due to processes including the details of the environment around it. Even though these changes are typically very small in atomic clocks, the ability of these amazing clocks to measure these small changes in timing allows them to see the very small effects in a very clear way, and thus can be used to measure or explore the details of the world around them. So a good example of this is that these clocks can be used to study the laws of gravity, including Einstein's general theory of relativity, as well as alternative gravitational theories that are meant to replace the theory of relativity. So one important prediction of general relativity is called the gravitational redshift. That basically says that if you have a clock which is sitting in a strong gravitational field, it'll actually tick slower than that same clock if it weren't in the gravitational field. And this is a relatively small effect. It has definitely been seen already with the performance of atomic clocks over decades. But as these clocks become better and better, you're able to basically make the measurement of what the effect on the clock is at a higher level of precision and ultimately test whether or not the influence predicted by general relativity is correct or whether alternative theories which have slightly different predictions are in fact correct. So this is a useful way of testing some of these theories of physics that might ultimately kind of change the way that we look at the universe. Mm-hmm. From a more pragmatic standpoint, you can actually turn that effect around and use these amazing timekeepers to measure the gravitational field. This actually could have some interesting applications for hydrology, geology, and perhaps even some climate change studies. So again, once you get to these kind of levels of measurement, you open the door for starting to make some very useful measurements that influence other fields of science and technology.
All right. Well, Andrew Ludlow, thank you so much.
That's my pleasure.
Andrew Ludlow reports on an atomic clock with 10 to the minus 18 instability in this week's Science.
We are built cell by cell by protein machines, machines made of and made by proteins. But what if one of the main machines needed to build proteins is broken? I'm talking about ribosomes, a key cellular component needed to translate RNA into protein strands. Now, the sudden ease of genome scans has revealed that having malfunctioning ribosomes is not a fatal condition. This week, Susan Becerra looks into the mystery of ribosomopathies, a surprising variety of diseases caused by faulty ribosomes.
So over the past 15 years, there's been increasing evidence that a number of rare human genetic diseases are caused by mutations in proteins, constituents of the ribosome itself, or in the constituents that make ribosomes. These diseases are called ribosomopathies, and they're very mysterious to us because they have tissue specificity in the nature of their disease, and we don't understand why a disease of ribosomes would cause tissue specificity.
Right. Well, ribosomes are very complex assemblages. Can you describe some of the important components?
Ribosomes are the molecular machines that make most of the proteins in all of our cells, and they're composed of both RNA and protein. RNA, turns out, is the catalytic moiety that catalyzes the peptidyl transferase activity of the ribosome. Most of the ribosomes are constituted of RNA, but they also have about 80 different ribosomal proteins, and these proteins play an important role in translation as well.
Okay. As you said in your intro, even though all cells need ribosomes, defects in them don't always kill off an embryo, but they do cause disease. Can you run down some of the ribosomopathies for us?
So the ribosomopathies that are particularly mysterious to us are things like Diamond-Blackfan anemia. And this is a bone marrow failure syndrome that affects children under 1 year of age, primarily in the erythroid lineage. So these are children who have a failure to make red blood cells. Mm. Treacher-Collins is another disease that is a mutation in a protein that makes ribosomes, and that causes craniofacial dysmorphology. Shwachman-Diamond-Bodian syndrome is also a bone marrow failure syndrome, but of the white cell lineage, and it also causes pancreatic insufficiency, but only in the exocrine pancreas. So insulin production is normal, but production of digestive enzymes is not. My laboratory works on a disease called North American Indian Childhood Cirrhosis that affects a small population of First Nations people outside of Quebec and Canada. The very newest ribosomopathy is called isolated congenital asplenia, and people are born without a spleen. And they can live without a spleen, except if they encounter a bacteria that might cause a very serious illness.
So, as you pointed out before, these are all completely diverse diseases that arise from a malfunctioning ribosome or a piece of the ribosome not working correctly. So how is that possible? One suggestion you make in your story is that the rapidly dividing cells, that they're going to be the ones that bear the brunt of this damage. How does that theory hold up?
So lots of physician scientists have proposed this as an explanation for things like Diamond-Blackfan anemia. For example, since it's a failure of the bone marrow to make red blood cells, they have argued that it's important to make a lot of the protein hemoglobin in the red blood cell, and failure to make adequate numbers of ribosomes leads to the bone marrow failure. But the way I think about it is that not only does the bone marrow need to make a lot of proteins, but to make a human being, you need to make a lot of proteins, and so you would need ribosomes for that. So that would argue against that being the only explanation.
So what other kind of theories are out there for this tissue proclivity?
we propose two different ideas. And one idea is that instead of thinking as a ribosome as a monolithic machine, we might think of ribosomes as having different specialities. And those different specialities may occur in the different tissues where we see the diseases. For example, these are examples of not diseases, but examples from people studying the importance of the different ribosomal proteins in human development. There's a good example from Maria Barna's lab, where she depleted the ribosomal protein L38, so this is a component of the large subunit of the ribosome, and she sees a specific developmental defect in the homeobox genes. And this was totally unexpected and brought up the whole idea that ribosomes may be different in different cell types and that perhaps we're kind of overthinking about ribosomes as these monolithic machines and that they might have specialized functions.
Really interesting. So your first example is that maybe there are different assemblages in different cells or maybe during different times.
I forgot to tell you why that's important. So you might have actually different ribosomes, these ideas of specialized ribosomes, but the specialized ribosomes may then lead to making different proteins.
Are you suggesting there might be different ribosomes assemblages in the same cell?
No. So the way I think about it is that these specialized ribosomes would preferentially be required to translate certain proteins and not others, and that would then lead to the different kinds of cell types that we see affected by these diseases.
And so did you say you had a second idea about why this might be?
And so our second idea, and this is probably true for diseases like diamond black fan anemia and for North American Indian childhood cirrhosis, where in those cases the mutations affect the levels of the ribosomal proteins, the constituents of the ribosome, and so these ribosomes would be decreased, and that in turn would also affect translation of certain messenger RNAs affecting the protein composition of different cells. And so there are different ways that you might get different mRNAs translated, and it's both by thinking of the ribosome not as a monolithic entity, but by something that's either specialized or affected by levels.
So how are we going to get these options sorted out? Is it possible that both of those things are going on?
So it's not only possible, but likely. And the third thing that unites those two is the idea of nuclear stress. And this is an idea that was proposed about 10 years ago by Ruby and Milner. And what they suggested was that if you interrupt a ribosome biogenesis in the nucleolus, that can lead to P53 stabilization. So let me tell you for a minute what P53 is. So this is the so-called guardian of the genome. That's the epithet that follows P53. It's the guardian of the genome. It's a protein. And when you interrupt ribosome biogenesis, P53 is stabilized. So the levels go up. And when the levels go up, that leads to cell death in a form called apoptosis. So it's likely that some of these ribosomopathies, because they decrease the levels of ribosomes, also activate the P53 response, and that leads to cell death. And this is probably what's going on, and Paul Trainer's lab has shown this, in Treacher-Collins syndrome, which is a cranial facial dysmorphology, and he showed it in a mouse model.
And so why would that be different in different cell types?
So it could be, and that's an excellent question, it could be that the P53 response only happens in certain cell types. For example, in Treacher-Collins syndrome, the cell types that it's affected is in the cranial neural crest. Perhaps those cells are more sensitive to interruption of ribosome biogenesis and activation of P53 than the other cells that form the embryo. And that's something that is under investigation.
Great. Well, is there any other thing that people are doing to sort out this question?
So I think that it's a very exciting time in ribosome biogenesis and in understanding ribosomopathies. And I think that there are various approaches that people are taking using different kinds of tissue culture cells, looking for different P53 responses or different ribosome biogenesis patterns. I think we're also going to be served well by working with model systems like mouse, fish, frog, and fly. And I think that once a number of us sit down and focus on these things, we'll be able to sort out which of these things might be happening and hopefully be able to help and prevent these diseases that people are afflicted with.
Great. Well, Susan Becerra, thank you so much.
Thank you, Sarah.
Susan Becerra and Kathleen McCann write about the unsolved mystery of ribosomopathies in A Perspective This Week.
The B612 Foundation plans to save the world, as grandiose as that sounds. In 2012, the nonprofit announced plans to build and operate the first privately funded interplanetary mission. Their goal is to raise $450 million to discover, map, and track asteroids on a collision course with Earth. Robert Irian discusses the Foundation's detection telescope and the dangers we face from asteroids.
For the last decade or so, astronomers have been trying to identify the biggest ones, the ones that could really cause a global catastrophe, and these are maybe a kilometer across or larger. And telescopes have identified now more than 90% of those objects, and none of them are on dangerous trajectories. But there are many other smaller objects, even down to something maybe only 40 meters across, that could really cause a problem. That is the size of an asteroid that exploded over Siberia in 1908 in an incident called the Tunguska explosion. And if that had been in a populated area, many people would have died. It flattened about 2,000 square kilometers of forest. And that was the last truly major impact a little bit more than 100 years ago. You might remember in February of this year, there was a smaller asteroid that exploded near Chelyabinsk, Russia. That one was about 17 meters across. It didn't kill anyone, but it injured about 1,000 people from the effects of a shock wave that destroyed a bunch of windows and damaged buildings in the nearby city of Chelyabinsk. No one saw that coming. Now, that kind of asteroid is probably too small even for telescopes to detect in advance, but the somewhat bigger ones, the ones that are the size of the Tunguska asteroid or larger, those could be spotted by very good surveys, but astronomers simply haven't done those thorough surveys yet. We've only seen about 1% of the objects larger than 40 meters that are expected to be in Earth's vicinity.
So what's the purpose of setting up a private foundation? Why not just depend on governments?
NASA has a very tight budget. There are precious few opportunities to launch new missions devoted to planetary science. And it would cost on the order of $500 million or more to do a mission like this. So it hasn't yet been part of NASA's budget, even though Congress is very keen on having the government detect these asteroids. So a private group based in California has gone forward with plans to raise money philanthropically to do this mission themselves. And they have designed a mission that would last for 6.5 years, and it would detect 90% or more of the objects that are roughly 140 meters in size or bigger, and those are the ones that Congress has really mandated NASA to detect by the year 2020. And at current rates, NASA's not going to get the job done. So this private facility would find most of those 140-meter size objects, and those are really capable of devastating a region or a big part of a continent if they were to hit. And it will also find a substantial fraction of the Tunguska-sized asteroids, down to about 40 meters. They are talking about launching this mission as early as 2018, and they need to raise about $450 million to do it.
How do they plan to detect asteroids that are on a collision course with Earth?
So this mission would be called Sentinel. It would be launched toward the planet Venus, and then it would settle into an orbit around the sun that is similar to the orbit of the planet Venus. And it would basically drift in that orbit for 6.5 years, and it would stare away from the sun at all times, out towards the direction of Earth's orbit.
Why orbit the satellite there and not closer to Earth?
In that alignment, any asteroids that are near Earth or that have pathways that take them close to Earth's orbit will be fully illuminated by the sun, because the sun will be behind the observatory. And that's the way that you can spot them most easily, because they are warmed by the sun's heat. They glow quite brightly in infrared light. So they pop out against the background stars if you observe in this manner. And it would be a modest-sized telescope, only about half a meter across, but with very sensitive infrared detectors. And they would beam this data back to Earth and analyze the images for new moving objects that are small and potentially dangerous in Earth's neighborhood.
So who are the people spearheading this mission?
That's one of the great parts of this story, is the B612 Foundation was founded by a team of four people, two of whom are former NASA astronauts. One of them is Ed Liu. He is the CEO of the foundation. He flew in space three times, most recently in 2003 for 6 months on the International Space Station, when he and a Russian cosmonaut named Yuri Malenchenko were a skeleton crew on the space station. This was in the immediate aftermath of the Columbia shuttle disaster. Ed is very passionate about planetary protection. He actually had a lucrative job at Google as a director of their special projects, but he stepped away from that job to devote most of his energies to the B612 Foundation. The other former astronaut who was involved with founding the group is Rusty Schweikert. He was on the Apollo 9 mission in 1969. He was one of the astronauts selected for NASA's third group of astronauts in the early 1960s during the height of the Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo programs. And he tested the lunar module in Earth orbit, which was one of the critical missions toward the Apollo 11 moon landing. And when it became apparent that it was perhaps possible to deflect asteroids from impacting the Earth, Ed and Rusty and a couple of planetary scientists got together and established this private foundation to study those plans. So their slogan is detect and deflect. So they want to find all of these objects, or as many of them as they can, and then if there are any on threatening trajectories, to have feasibly demonstrated technological missions to steer them away from impacting Earth.
So you mentioned that their slogan is detect and deflect. Do they have plans to also produce something that can deflect asteroids as well?
The foundation itself studied possible ways of doing so, but they have no intention or no capacity to actually build the deflection technology themselves. If a dangerous asteroid is found, then that probably is something that the international scientific community would need to come together and build the necessary technology.
So what is the scientific community's reaction towards this? Are there any criticisms? And if so, what are they?
In general, the community of planetary scientists is quite keen on this project. When the B612 Foundation announced its plans, they hired some of the best people in the business. And there is a sense of almost relief, I would say, that someone is moving forward with this mission in the light of NASA's inability to get this done, because NASA simply doesn't have the funding to get this done. The one technical criticism is some scientists believe that the satellite actually would work better if it was closer to Earth. And the reason for that is twofold. One is, at the distance of Venus, and as the satellite goes around the sun, sometimes it will be on the far side of the sun as seen from Earth, because an object in the orbit of Venus will go around the sun more quickly than Earth does. So sometimes it will be quite far away, and that means that they will not actually be able to transmit all of the data to Earth. The communications capabilities are not good enough for all of the data to be transmitted over such long distances. So an onboard computer will have to sift through some of the images first and discard any that don't have moving objects in them, or that appear not to have moving objects in them. So radio telescopes on Earth will actually only receive something like 1/1,000th of the data from the Sentinel. Now, the way that they've designed it is that this will be the most critical portion of the data. It will be the data in which the computer on the telescope believes that there is a new moving object to be identified. But some astronomers are concerned that the portion of the data that will be discarded might have other faint objects lurking in it that would become apparent if they were to do really close analysis. So that's a compromise that has been built into the mission. The designers are fully aware of this. One other concern is that all of this money, this $450 million, would need to be raised philanthropically. They're going to have a roughly 10-year period to raise this money. They are aiming to raise $20 million in this first year. And then after 2013, they're going to need to raise at least $40 million a year for the next decade in order for this mission to succeed. They have assured their colleagues that every time they talk about this mission with wealthy donors, they're getting a lot of interest, and people are fascinated with the prospect of helping to protect the planet in this innovative way.
Great. Well, Robert Irian, thanks for talking with me.
You're very welcome, Christy, and thank you for your interest in this story.
Robert Irian writes about defending the Earth against asteroids in this week's issue.
Finally today, we have David Grimm, online news editor for Science. He's here to give us a rundown of some of the recent stories from our daily news site. I'm Sarah Crespi. So first up, we have a story on what kinds of stories we can tell from a wolf's howl. I actually didn't know that wolf howls were mysterious. What were they thought to be used for in the past?
Well, they are mysterious. I mean, it's like one of the most common sounds you might associate with the great outdoors. But believe it or not, scientists actually don't know why wolves howl. They have a few hypotheses. One is that they're trying to contact other members of their group. Sometimes the group gets separated during a hunt, and howling is a way for everybody to gather back together again. The other idea is that it's sort of more of an involuntary response. Maybe they're just getting stressed out and, you know, an involuntary response to stress.
So this is one of those great studies where someone observes something, becomes curious enough to actually do the research. Can you talk about the instigation?
Well,
yeah,
that's right. I mean, this actually took place at a place called Wolf Science Center, which is in Austria. And actually, the people that work there noticed some interesting behaviors. They noticed when they would take their wolves for a walk, the other wolves would start to howl. So they said, well, you know, maybe there's a reason they're howling. Maybe it has something to do with this idea of wolves being separated and trying to reform the pack. But they had to do some experiments to actually figure out whether that was the case. Scientists there have actually been studying wolves for a long time. Not only have they been studying them, but they've actually been hand-raising them. So these wolves are fairly well-socialized to people. They're not like dogs, but they're not as dangerous or as frightened as wolves would be in the wild. So you can actually get up close to them and do some experiments with them.
So what was the setup? How did they study the wolf howl?
So what they did was they took some wolves, and they had this group of wolves. And first of all, they wanted to study the relationship between these wolves. There's always a dominant wolf. So who's the dominant wolf? Which wolves are better friends with each other than other wolves? They actually have these sort of complex social relationships. And then what they would do is they would pick a wolf, take it out of the pack, and sort of lead it away. And then they wanted to see what the other wolves would do. And the other wolves would howl, and sounded a little bit like this. And what they noticed, which was really striking, was that the wolves seemed to howl the most when it was the dominant wolf that was led away. And that wolves that had their friends led away also seemed to howl more than the other wolves did. And that suggested it wasn't just sort of this reflexive response, that there was sort of meaning behind this response. Like, hey, my friend is gone. Where is my friend? Or, hey, our pack leader is gone. Where is our pack leader?
Right. So it was tied to the social relationships.
Exactly.
So they took another step to rule out stress as a factor in howling. Can you talk about that?
Right. Well, again, something you could only do with tame or semi-tamed animals was they actually stuck cotton balls in the mouths of these wolves to test the levels of cortisol, which is a stress hormone. And what they found was they didn't see a relationship between stress and the howling. In other words, the wolves weren't getting stressed out when they were howling, which also indicates that it wasn't just an automatic response to stress, that the wolves were actually sort of thinking about what they were doing. They were really assessing the situation. And what this all sort of combines to show is that it really provides support for this hypothesis that wolves are calling to sort of reform the pack, that when the pack gets separated, howling is a way to bring everybody back together again.
Right. So can they make that determination with a purely captive population like this?
Well, it's a great question. I mean, obviously, these wolves are somewhat compromised because they have been raised by humans. They're not going to have identical behaviors as they would have in the wild. So that's the one limitation of the study, is that we don't know whether this holds true for wild populations. But at least it's the strongest evidence yet that's sort of cracking this mystery of why wolves howl.
Next up, we have a story on biomarkers for suicide. Usually when we want to investigate someone's mental state, we're stuck with just asking, so tell me how you feel. But that might change.
Right. The problem with suicide is it's not like a heart attack. You don't go to your doctor often and say, I'm thinking about committing suicide. Maybe you would go to your psychiatrist and say that. But if you didn't say it, your doctor has no way, or your psychiatrist has no way to tell whether you might be contemplating suicide. It's not like a heart attack where, you know, your cholesterol levels could be checked, or your stress levels could be checked, or your blood pressure or things like that. We really don't have any biological markers, what people call biomarkers, to tell whether somebody might be at risk for killing themselves.
So in order to fish out these biomarkers, the researchers first focused on a tiny swath of the population. How did they narrow things down?
Well, what they wanted to do is they wanted to measure suicidal thoughts in single people, in individual people over time. So they had to find people that not only were contemplating suicide, but people that went from contemplating suicide to not contemplating suicide to going back to contemplating suicide again. That's obviously a pretty hard population to find. The researchers started with a whole bunch of people and eventually narrowed it down to 9 men who were experiencing this extreme shift from zero suicidal thoughts to what they call high suicidal ideation. And ideation basically just means thoughts ranging from feelings of worthlessness to actually specifically planning for suicide.
And so all those men had bipolar disorder.
That's
how
right.
They found them.
Yes.
What did they find out about these 9 men?
Well, they did a screen for a lot of different proteins circulating in these men's blood. And what they found was that there was one protein, which is made by a gene called SAT1, which is involved in cellular damage and stress. It's also been found to increase in response to a number of stressors to the body, such as toxins and infection. They found that this SAT1 protein was really elevated in these men when these men were thinking about killing themselves.
So that they started out by comparing it within a person. High levels in this person when they're thinking of suicide, low levels when they're not. But they next actually confirmed this in suicide victims.
Right. Obviously, they weren't going to wait for these men to kill themselves. And so what they did was they actually looked at some samples from bodies of people that had killed themselves. And what they found was really high levels of SAT1 in the blood of these deceased people.
So were they actually able to make predictions about behavior based on these markers?
They were. They looked at another population. They did a long-term study of 42 men with bipolar disorder and 46 men with schizophrenia. And what they found was that when combined with other psychological measures such as anxiety and mood, the biomarkers were more than 80% predictive of future hospitalization for suicide.
So, okay, time for the caveats. Would this work as a cold test without any other information? You just take a blood sample from a person?
No, the researchers are really being cautious about this. They're saying this isn't sort of a one-shot test. You would need to combine this information with information about mood, potentially what information about drugs or medication that these patients are on. This would just be one more variable you would add to the mix.
So this study almost exclusively focuses on people who have mental disorders already. Is it going to be able to be expanded out past that?
Well, and that's one of the other caveats. Not only is this a really small sample, it's only men with bipolar disorder. You're really not getting a representative sample of the entire population. So this really needs to be tested in a lot more people. A lot more studies have to be done, a lot more long-term studies. And again, this particular protein by itself is not going to be predictive of suicide. It's going to need to be combined with other measures.
Finally, we have a story on how biggest isn't always best. The big question is, when the biggest horns or the most glorious tail attract the best mates. Why is there such a variety of male horn size or tail size in these populations?
Right. The big question, Sarah, is why aren't all of these animal populations just filled with super males?
Yeah.
Because the question is, I mean, over evolutionary time, the males that are bigger, the males that are stronger, the males that are faster, those are the ones that are going to get more mates, they're going to have more offspring, and ostensibly their genes are going to be more likely to be passed down to the next generation. So you would assume that over time, every male in a population is going to be this super amazing male. But that's not what we see.
Right. That's a really big question. So let's narrow it down to sheep.
Well, the thing with sheep is that they have, as you alluded to, they have some of them have these really big horns, but some sheep have these really small horns that aren't as effective and aren't going to be as attractive to females because they don't appear as strong. This is one of those studies where researchers had access to a really interesting population. This is a population of sheep that live on an island off Scotland's coast. They've been studied for decades, actually. So researchers know a whole lot, not just about the biology of these animals, but about their behaviors, their relationships. And so a team was actually able to go in. They studied 1,750 sheep on this island over two decades. And what they found was that there was actually two what are called alleles or versions of the horn gene that gives these sheep their variety of horns. And some sheep carry two alleles for big, strong horns, and some sheep carry two alleles for kind of weaker, smaller horns, and some sheep carry one of each, which sort of gives them a sort of intermediate type of horn. And what they found was, as you expect, the males with the big horns and the genes for these big horns did really well. They had a lot more mates. They sired a lot more offspring. But what was interesting is that even the sheep with the small puny horns still sired offspring. They just sired a lot less.
Okay, so what about the middle guys, the ones who have a little bit of big and a little bit of small?
Well, those guys sort of got the best of both worlds because they were able to sire a fair number of offspring. But what they and the guys that had the two alleles for even the puny horns were able to do was, because they're not spending all this time fighting other males and they don't have these big harems of females that they have to take care of, they're actually able to spend a lot more time eating, sort of taking care of themselves, and they actually tend to live a lot longer. And why that's significant is because as they live longer, they have more chances to mate. So even though they're not siring a whole lot of offspring in a short amount of time, as the big, powerful males are, over a long amount of time, they are siring a lot of offspring, which explains why their genes are persisting in the population and why we still have a lot of sort of weaker males mixed in with the super tough guys.
So what's the larger message that we can take away from this study?
Well, this study really shows why we have this kind of diversity in a population, why you wouldn't just have these populations composed of super males, because there are advantages to those genes that convey big horns, but there are also disadvantages as well. And it helps maintain a lot of variety in these populations, which is really important. You can even think about in humans, some people have genes that protect against malaria, but also make them susceptible to sickle cell anemia. That's a very classic example in biology. And the reason those genes have stuck around is because even though they're deleterious in some respects, they're also protective in others.
So what else is on the site this week, Dave?
Well, Sarah, for Science Now, we've got a story about why male humpback whales sing. Also a story about how feral cats in places like Australia may not be as much of an invasive species as some scientists have thought. And for Science Insider, our policy blog, we've got a story about how a diplomatic flap between the EU and Israel is threatening research collaborations between the two countries. Also a story about whether free scientific articles are the future of scientific publishing. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Sarah.
David Grimm is the online editor for Science's daily news site. You can check out the latest news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org. I'm Sarah Crespi. And that concludes the August 23rd, 2013 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Sarah Crespi.
And I'm Christy Hamilton. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.